It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Welcome to Body Week. In this space, we will dive into major systems, tackling the heart, the lungs, the gut, muscles, and bones. And we start with the brain, which is busy and awesome. The Cleveland Clinic says our brain processes 70,000 thoughts a day. Calling about brain health and curiosities, implants through brain surgery, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Lee Hochberg is here, neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, leads its Center for Neurotechnology and Neuro Recovery. He's a professor of engineering at Brown University. Dr. Hochberg, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's great to be here.
Good morning. And we also have Dr. Shahram Majidi, an assistant professor of neurosurgery and neurology and radiology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Brooklyn. Dr. Majidi, welcome.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good morning. Dr. Majidi, let's start with you. Last summer, you implanted a device on the brain of a patient with the progressive nervous system disease, ALS. Can you describe the implant and the procedure to install it?
Yeah, it's a very exciting time to be a brain surgeon with this advances in technology these days. So this was part of the clinical trial called COMMAND trial. Which was the first in-human experience in the United States with implanting a minimally invasive endovascular brain-computer interface, or BCI, in a patient with severe paralysis from ALS disease.
How did you choose the location of the implant? You said it's minimally invasive. What is special about where you put this device in the brain?
So the idea of a brain-computer interface is not a new. Great physicians, scientists, and surgeons have been working on this for decades. But the new technology allowed us to now have an endovascular version of brain-computer interface. Traditionally, all BCI devices had required open brain surgery or drilling a hole into someone's brain to access the brain and then implant that device either within the brain tissue or over the surface of the brain. The stent rode brain-computer interface, however, is a device that you don't need to perform an open brain surgery. We don't need to cut the skin or remove the bone. But what we do, we go through the normal natural highways of the brain, which are the vessels, the veins in this circumstance. We access the vein similar to how we do a vein access to get the blood sample and navigate a small, tiny, less than 2 millimeter catheter within the vein until we reach the brain area and then deploy that device intravascularly within the vessel without violating the brain anatomy. So that's what we perform. Since then, we have been able to implant two more devices in two other patients. And this is really very exciting to see. This is a very early safety and feasibility stage of this clinical trial, but we are very hopeful that this will be the beginning of new era.
A beginning of a new era. I want to bring Professor Hochberg in here as Dr. Majidi describes this stent rode approach and how it differs from what happened in the past with brain computer interface. Can you talk about the advancements?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So if we think about how somebody who's able-bodied moves, for example, how somebody may want to reach out and pick up a cup of coffee, that idea or that intention begins with signals in the brain. And there's a part of the brain called the motor cortex that's very important for generating movement. And those brain signals are then sent down through the center of the brain out to either the brainstem or the spinal cord. And then there are brain cells or neurons that then send those signals out to muscles and person reaches out and picks up their cup for the morning cup of coffee. For people who have any number of injuries or illnesses, for example, spinal cord injury, there's a disconnection between that intent or that desire to move and the ability to move. That is, there's truly a disconnection as the signals are trying to get from brain down to, for example, down to the arm. So brain computer interface is an opportunity to listen to those brain signals that are involved in trying to generate that movement. And there are now different ways to listen to those brain signals. And rather than reconnecting down to the arm, though that may be possible, and there have been examples of that already in the past, there's other ways to bring those brain signals out, for example, to a computer to allow somebody to control a cursor on a computer screen simply by thinking about the movement of their own hand.
That is just really exciting and has so much potential. I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Dr. Lee Hochberg is director of the BrainGate Consortium and clinical trials with Brown University. Dr. Sharam Majidi, director of cerebrovascular services at Mount Sinai, Brooklyn. You can join in on advancements in brain-computer interfaces. What you want to know, 800-642-1234. Dr. Majidi, you talked about that the surgery has been performed again a couple times, but how are these patients doing as you have operated on them and put these implants in? Dr. Majidi, can you hear us or are you on mute?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. The patients are doing great. They're going through normal training process, which was already planned during the study. Their follow-up imaging are showing normal recovery from the implantation. So this is, an exciting study that we will be following them for 1 year. And after completion of this study, we will have opportunity to do a larger efficacy trial where we will look into the actual efficacy and impact of this device in enhancing the patient's quality of life and elevating their independency during normal life activities.
From what you see right now, does this particular surgery make an initial impact on quality of life? Does it change someone's life initially when this electrode is placed on the brain?
Well, after a few weeks of training, our patients are able to notify their caregiver if they need the help. They're able to send a text message. They're able to communicate with their friends. They're able to do online shopping. I think that is a significant improvement in quality of life for someone who is bedridden and completely disconnected from the outside world.
In that locked-in type situation, Professor Hochberg, who stands to be helped by this particular type of minimally invasive surgery, this brain-computer interface?
There's a number of people who have different diseases or injuries of the nervous system who could potentially benefit from an implanted brain-computer interface. And it's important to point out that all of these BCIs, implanted BCIs in particular, are in their early research stages. They are, in our case, in the ongoing BrainGate clinical trials. These trials have been going on now for more than 18 years, and the wonderful new trial that Dr. Majidi is referring to, now going on in the U.S., and it's been happening for a few years in Australia as well. As far as the people who we hope these devices will help, they're people who may have cervical spinal cord injury, that is spinal cord injury at the top of the spinal cord, resulting in tetraplegia or quadriplegia, the inability to move one's arms or legs. In addition, people with ALS, that's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. People who have brainstem stroke, who again may be not only unable to move, but also unable to speak in some cases. And a number of other diseases, both that happen acutely or that may be there even from early on in life, that we're all hopeful that these BCIs will eventually be helpful for.
Dr. Lee Hochberg is a vascular and critical care neurologist, works on neuroscience discoveries as an engineering professor at Brown University. We have neurosurgeon Shahram Majidi, performs this minimally invasive surgery to implant a brain-computer device in a patient as we explore what that means. Call in about the brain and what you consider to be the next frontier brain medicine of these implants, what's possible, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore what's possible through brain chip implants in patients and future applications for treating devastating neurological conditions. Join in on what questions or comments you have about implanting small electronic devices inside the brain, 800-642-1234. Dr. Shahram Majidi is a neurosurgeon and assistant professor of neurosurgery, neurology, and radiology at Mount Sinai. And neurologist Lee Hochberg leads the Center for Neurotechnology and Neurorecovery at Massachusetts General. Dr. Hochberg, you lead the BrainGate team and brain-computer interface group that's developed in conjunction with Brown University, and your team published a study recently on the safety of the technology, really unpacking 17 years of data. What were your findings?
So over the past 17 years, there have been 14 people who have engaged in the BrainGate clinical trials. And just to describe the device that they've been using, there's a 4x4 millimeter that is a kind of baby aspirin size array of electrodes. And that little platform has 96 active electrodes, about a millimeter and a half tall, that get tapped into the top of the brain, and particularly into the top of the brain called the motor cortex, which is so important for the voluntary control of movement. That device is then placed there for a year or more, and then people have been at home using this system, either together with our researchers or on their own, for control of a cursor on a computer screen, for control sometimes of a robotic arm, and for other devices that may become helpful for their own quality of life.
And you found a very low rate of any negative things happening from these implantable devices.
We did. Thankfully, over this now 14 participants and 17 years, there was a very low rate of adverse events associated with the device. And for any new medical technology, it's these early clinical research studies that are so important to really ask the question, will these devices be safe? And will the benefit to risk ratio be justified as these devices continue to be developed and we all hope become available to the people who would benefit from them?
And BrainGate's gone wireless now in these devices. Is that a significant step?
It is. We've now been able to use what we would call a percutaneous, that is a through the skin still wireless device. But traditionally in this research, the user, that is the participant in the research study, had been connected by a cable, that is the array in the brain was connected through the skin to a cable, which would then go back to the computers that would decode the intended movement of the hand through that brain activity that was being recorded. We can now use a wireless transmitter rather than that cable. And that wireless transmitter allows the user of the device to be, for example, sitting in their wheelchair without being directly connected to the computers that are doing the rest of the work of decoding that brain activity in real time.
And that must feel like so much more freedom when there aren't the wires, or at least aren't the visible wires. That can mean a lot for a patient.
It can, and it's a step towards a fully implanted system, and I suspect that Shahram will be able to describe the fully implanted system that they've been using most recently. The real goal for these devices is in many ways for them to be invisible. That is fully implanted, much like a cardiac pacemaker or a deep brain stimulator that somebody may use who has Parkinson's disease. There are millions of pacemakers, hundreds of thousands of deep brain stimulators that have been placed. And to the observer of somebody who's using one of these devices, they're essentially invisible because they're fully implanted. And that's the goal for brain-computer interfaces as well.
Dr. Majidi, as you work toward that fully implantable, encased piece of machinery in the brain, are there concerns, though, about computers needing reboots, computers freezing? I mean, this would be a high-stakes malfunction inside a person's brain.
Yeah, interesting question. So, yeah, the stent rod is fully implanted. I would like to start with just describing how we do it, and then we talk about the computer part of it. So we make a very tiny needle access from the neck, which will give us access to the vein. Then we navigate the stent rod device to the brain next to the motor cortex, which we had previously identified using a structural MRI. So after deploying the device within the vessel in the brain next to the motor cortex, then the distal end of the wire in the neck, we tunnel it into the either right or left side of the chest, similar to DBS devices or some of the pacemakers. We create a small pocket and then put the receiver, which we call it IRTU or generator, underneath the skin in the subcutaneous pocket in the chest. But then this device, then we suture it back. Everything is inside the body, and this receiver will be connected to the external computer through a Bluetooth technology. The implanted part of the device, before we close the incision, we check the connectivity. And if it is connected, it is not going to require any reboot. However, the external computer, similar to any other computer, can have some functional moment that might require some update or reboot. So that is not a major concern for us.
Dr. Sharam Majidi there and Dr. Lee Hochberg, as we look at the potential of brain-computer interfaces, you can join along the way at 800-642-1234. Professor Hochberg, Elon Musk's startup Neuralink, I just want to touch down there, has applied for FDA approval to begin human trials later this year, but there have been calls for the FDA to discipline Neuralink for its invasive and gruesome tests on monkeys and sheep and pigs. How safe are these interfaces that are heading to market now?
So, important question, Kate, and important disclosure as well. I do have the opportunity to interact with Neuralink through a clinical research support agreement with the hospital that I work at. So clearly what we'll be discussing are all things that are really relative to brain-computer interfaces in general, including implanted ones. But I refer you and your listeners to the company itself for more specific information about that device. Having said that, the question they're asking is incredibly important. For any patient, for any person who's considering any medical device, we have to weigh the risks and the benefits of that particular device. And that's the reason why these initial early stage clinical studies, these safety studies are done, to look very carefully and rigorously at any adverse events that may happen that are related to the device or related to the surgery. And then even if there may be some of those, and hopefully a very small rate of those adverse events, to consider those in the context of the potential benefit that that device may provide. For example, being able to provide 24-hour day, 7-day a week control over a computer to restore the ability for somebody with extremely limited communication to be able to interact with their family and their friends and their caregivers. And it's really weighing these risks and benefits that will ultimately be how we determine whether a device is an appropriate one for somebody to use. And the most important person in making that decision is going to be the person themselves who's considering using that device.
Neurologist Lee Hochberg, engineering professor at the Kearney Institute for Brain Science at Brown, Dr. Sharam Majidi, neurointerventional surgeon at Mount Sinai. Colin, about brain health, what you wonder about implantable technology that could transform the treatment of complex neurological conditions. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Welcome to Body Week as we focus on the brain, where scientists believe information travels at a speed of 300 miles an hour. We explore the future of implantable devices, translating brain signals from the inside of a blood vessel, allowing patients with severe paralysis to communicate through their electronic devices via their mind. Join in with your questions, your stories about brain research and implants, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Shahram Majidi, a neurosurgeon and assistant professor of neurosurgery, neurology, and radiology at Mount Sinai. And neurologist Lee Hochberg is here, directs the Center for Neurotechnology and Neurorecovery at Massachusetts General. Dr. Hochberg, BrainGate is, you know, talking, making claims, right? Controlling robotic arms, and there are claims to restoring communication. And then we have, you know, others in the space, Synchron, looking at, you know, robotic arms, and Neuralink talking about restoring sight to people who are blind. What are the limitations of this type of technology?
So Kate, I spent some of my weekend as a neurointensive care physician, taking care of people who had acute injuries or illnesses of the nervous system and suddenly lost the ability to speak or lost the ability to move. And I'm really excited by the fact that there are now, in addition to our own ongoing academic efforts to develop brain-computer interfaces, that there are multiple companies who are developing new and exciting ideas and methods for recording from the brain and hopefully developing those through to the point that they're properly tested and thoroughly tested and find their way to market and eventually allow people with severe forms of paralysis to be able to communicate more readily, to be able to move again. So the field is incredibly exciting. In terms of the limitations, when I think of the field, I'm reminded that you just mentioned the speed at which neural information travels around the brain. Somewhere in some textbook, I was told that there's 100 billion neurons in the brain. Not exactly sure who counted, but that sounds like a lot. and what continues to amaze me, despite a couple decades in this field, is that if we're able to record from just a few dozen of that 100 billion, we can decode the intention for somebody to be moving their hand, or to be moving their hand and reaching out to pick up a coffee cup, or even the ability to handwrite the letters that they're attempting to write despite being unable to use their hand. And so the excitement is substantial, and I think the potential for this field is substantial. And the limitations at the moment are largely based on the fact that we're only recording from a few dozen, let's say even if it's a couple hundred neurons at a time, or if we're above the brain, not really recording from the neurons themselves, if we're recording from the summed activity of a group of neurons that are working together, the fact that that signal can be informative and can be used by somebody for improved communication or improved mobility is really exciting, but I suspect it's just going to get better and better as there's greater opportunity to record simultaneously from multiple places in the brain.
Dr. Majidi, you know, the prospects are vast, and what you could possibly do as a neurosurgeon, how do you not lose sight of overpromising or also, looking at, you know, taking these limitations to heart and trying to be realistic about them?
That's a critical point. I completely agree with Lee. There are like multiple efforts, different companies and multiple clinical trials running now, testing different devices in terms of their safety and efficacy in this space. This is a very good thing, an exciting thing. None of them are perfect. Some a little better or safer, but eventually this accumulated effort will help us to really help some of our very, very sickest patients. You know, just remember, over 5 million people in the United States live with severe paralysis. It could be from stroke, from demyelinating disease, from neurodegeneration like ALS or muscular dystrophy or trauma, car accident or neuromuscular diseases. This effort will eventually help us to identify some of these patients that we can help them to become a little more independent in their daily life and able to communicate with outside world and be able to enjoy during their daily activities.
Meanwhile, Dr. Hochberg, we see hundreds of millions of dollars of startup capital flowing toward these devices and these technology startups. Is that a concern, or how do you negotiate that?
Yeah, so I think it's important for us to remember all that the reason that the field exists and the fact that we've got to this wonderful point of being able to talk about the future of restoring lost neurologic function is because of decades, really more than 50 years of publicly funded fundamental neuroscience and neuroengineering. Understanding how the brain works, understanding how groups of neurons can be recorded chronically, how that the information in that neural activity can be decoded in real time, leading to early clinical trials demonstrating that it's in fact possible for somebody who's unable to move their hand to control an external device just by thinking about it. But even with that continued, and it's that investment, that public investment in science, either through the National Institutes of Health, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and other public agencies and philanthropies, academic institutions, medical institutions, as academic medical centers, hospitals, universities, don't make the final form of a medical device that then gets tested in its final form and marketed and supported and sold. That is appropriately the role of a company. So the translation of this critically important and ongoing public investment to develop these devices, the last step of that is the formation of a company, the creation of a device, and that device then gets kind of locked down. It gets frozen for a moment so that it can be tested. We can look at its safety and its efficacy. And then if all goes well, it finds its way to market and becomes available to the people who we hope that these devices will help. So when I see that that investment, that is that private investment going, the company is developing this, I'm excited. It means that there's actually been enough progress made in this field that it is time for the companies to begin investing and to developing their product that will hopefully prove its utility.
Can you help us understand where it is at, this technology, in the FDA's regulatory process?
So the FDA has an important role in looking at both the safety and the efficacy of these devices. I've had the opportunity to interact with the FDA for years for our own BrainGate trials, and the FDA is really, you know, in this neurologic devices group, they are outstanding in their care, their attention. They have an important job to do, which is to make sure that these clinical trials are designed and reported in a way that meets both with the code and federal expectations of this type of research, and that the information is being looked at carefully. Their role is continues to be important, and I think that all of these studies, the one that Sharam is referring to, the one that I'm referring to, and the others, they either haven't started yet in others' cases, or the ones that are happening now are at their early stages. They're looking at safety. They're looking at feasibility. They're asking the question, is it possible that this device should go for a larger clinical trial, one that would really focus down on the question is, does this device work well enough, consistently enough to justify any of the surgical risk that may be involved in placing it?
Dr. Lee Hochberg there and Dr. Sharam Majidi, as we talk about the possibilities and the cautions, limitations of new brain-computer interfaces, you can join in along the way at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Majidi, as you look at the path forward, at the regulatory path forward, how are these implantable devices maintained and monitored? We talked a little bit about the glitches outside of the implant, but how do you ensure the technology continues to, be strengthened and improved once it is inside your patient?
Well, we need to show that the device has durability, because when we implant this device within the patient brain, this is a lifelong implant that has to be shown in the regulatory process to FDA. So that's one thing that has happened with stent road device. Then there are, of course, when when we're talking about many years of having a foreign body or implant inside the body, there's going to be some issues associated with that. When it comes to endovascular brain-computer interface, this is completely a new space for us. You know, in medicine, we used to have DBS or pacemaker, but having an implant going from the chest up to the brain within the vascular space is a new concept. That's why the safety trials are important. And that's the reason we are doing this 6 patients in our early feasibility stage. We are monitoring them closely with serial imaging, clinical examination, and also their training and performance with the device over the course of 12 months. You're going to learn a lot of new knowledge on how the body reacts to this and how the patient performs with that and how we deal with new issues and things that we probably didn't know before. So, and overall, our knowledge will be expanded and which will be used the next in designing the next generation of this device. That's why I mentioned at the beginning, we are just at the early stage and beginning of new era, which I call endovascular brain modulation, which is not going to be just limited to receiving signal from brain, but also over the course of following years, you're going to have endovascular devices that can be used to do some neuromodulation, which can be potentially used in treatment of depression and some psychiatric disorders and movement disorders, etc. So what we are doing today will have impact in a decade to come.
Okay, let's bring on a call now. Dana in Oshkosh. Dana, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call and thank you for this great program today. I just wanted to ask our speakers, what proportion of these patients that might be considered assisted by these devices are, they're just not good candidates for any kind of surgery, minimally invasive surgeries? Can you comment on a percent of patients that just aren't going to be able to access this technology? And number two is, isn't there such a wide range of neurodiversity in healthy humans, let alone those with the problems that might be responded to with these devices, that it's never going to be a one-size-fits-all? So I'm looking at patient diversity, both in their candidacy for having any surgery at all, and then also the nature of their disorder. That's my question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Appreciate it, Dana. Thank you so much. Dr. Majidi, you first.
Great question, Dana. Yeah, so we have a standard inclusion criteria. When it comes to endovascular brain-computer interface, we screen the patient for eligibility. Specifically for this device, we obtain MR venogram, which will show us the venous structure of the brain. We make sure the patient has patent venous system so we can navigate the device through this. And in terms of other eligibilities, the patient shouldn't have active infection. Specifically, the patient needs to have a caregiver and some care support around him who can help the patient in terms of the training process, which will immediately start after implantation to help the patient to utilize the device. So pretty standard inclusion-exclusion criteria, as long as the patient has a normal range of brain anatomy and vascular anatomy of the brain, we should be able to navigate the device to the target area. In terms of the variability of the brain structure, in this version of Stentrode, our target area is motor cortex in the brain. We identify that with obtaining a structural brain MRI, and then you have the target area when you're doing endovascular surgery, and we know where to how to precisely deliver the device next to that motor cortex.
Dr. Hochberg, what comes up for you and Dana's questions?
Sure. So the first and perhaps even most important thing that we can say over this hour is that the people who really deserve the credit in the development of these new technologies are the extraordinary participants in these early phase clinical trials. They're enrolling not because they're hoping to gain any personal benefit themselves, but they're enrolling to help us as a scientific and medical community to develop and test these devices so that we learn enough about them and we make them constantly better so that they might eventually become available to help other people with paralysis. So I just, you know, to this important question of safety, the folks who join us in these early clinical trials, we explain the risks as best as we can and as best as we know them, and they wonderfully join us in these trials, accepting some degree of risk and some degree of uncertainty with the goal of being able to help others. So they just deserve tremendous credit. In terms of the inclusion criteria for these devices, most early stage clinical trials are looking for people who, while they have the disease or injury that qualifies them to test and further develop the device, they are generally otherwise healthy. And even in the case of somebody who has ALS, that person may be using a mechanical ventilator to be able to breathe if they have a more advanced form of the disease, but they're otherwise awake and alert and able to interact and generally are otherwise healthy. The hope is that when these devices, and hopefully they will, find their way to approval and out to help the people who we're hoping that they will help, that a wider range of people might be able to benefit from them and to have those devices placed than would be possible in the typically fairly narrowly constrained early clinical trials. As your second point, one of the wonderful things about brain-computer interfaces is they're essentially designed to take advantage of the fact that we are all different, to take advantage of that diversity that you were referring to. If we're listening to some neurons in the brain and we've asked somebody to try to move their hand to the right, even if different people may have different neurons and different neural activities associated with that attempted movement, we're listening to that neural activity, the computer programs are detecting that activity, and they're decoding it, making for what is really an incredibly personalized brain-computer interface for each person. So I think this particular field is very well suited to be able to help a wide range of people with a number of different diseases and disorders, and of course, really taking advantage of the fact of the differences between all of us.
Wow. Thank you for those insights. We have critical care neurologist Lee Hochberg there at Massachusetts General. We have neurointerventional surgeon Sharam Majidi at Mount Sinai. As we focus on the brain, how neuroscience is being revolutionized through implantable devices that could have a wide range of applications. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Dr. Sharam Majidi, a neurosurgeon at Mount Sinai. Dr. Lee Hochberg is here, directs the Center for Neurotechnology and Neurorecovery at Massachusetts General and is a brain science professor at Brown University. I want to field this question to both of you as it is our body week. What is the most important thing we can do in our day to keep our brain healthy? Dr. Majidi, go ahead. Dr. Majidi, are you on mute? I don't think we can hear you at the moment. Dr. Hochberg, how about you? What is the one thing we can do in our day to keep our brain healthy?
There's a group of things that we can all do to keep our brains as healthy as possible. And I thought, because it was the beginning of Brain Week or Body Week, that you were going to ask us what's the most important part of the body. And of course, when you ask a neurologist and a neurosurgeon, you're pretty sure you're going to get the answer. But sticking with that for just a moment, everything that we're told to do to exercise regularly, to get sleep, to eat healthy, if somebody happens to have diabetes, to do everything they can to keep their blood sugar in range, to avoid smoking, to check one's blood pressure if they're an adult and to make sure that their blood pressure is within range. And if it's not, to speak with their primary care physician to make sure that their blood pressure is well controlled. Those typically very standard, admittedly standard pieces of advice apply extremely well to the brain, and they help to make sure that our brain stays as healthy as possible.
Dr. Majidi, you have the final words here on how to keep the brain healthy every day.
I can't agree more with Lee. So exercise, healthy diet, avoid smoking and drug. And because the best brain computer interface is the one that we are born with. So keep that healthy.
that is really amazing. I mean, do those really... It seems like simple things, but straightforward things, they do have a great impact, you find, on the brain. Dr. Majidi, are you there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Sharam Majidi is a neurosurgeon and assistant professor of neurosurgery, neurology, and radiology at Mount Sinai. Dr. Lee Hochberg is a critical care neurologist at Massachusetts General and an engineering and brain science professor at Brown University. And you can always email us about Body Week. What's on your mind? Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.